This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Today, Damned Lies and Statistics. That's the title of a new book from sociologist Joel Best. He's our guest in this portion of the program. We'll talk with him about sorting out all those numbers thrown about by politicians, activists, and the media. Best says in the introduction to Damned Lies and Statistics, bad statistics are used to promote all sorts of causes. Bad statistics come from conservatives on the political right and liberals on the left, from wealthy corporations and powerful government agencies, and from advocates of the poor and the powerless. But Best also says we cannot ignore statistics. He says we need them to talk sensibly about social issues. The trick is to be smart about statistics, and Best says that's easier than it sounds. Listeners, you can join us with your questions and comments this afternoon about statistics. Here are the telephone numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 1-800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Joel Best is professor and chair of sociology and criminal justice at the University of Delaware. He is the author of several books, including Random Violence. His new book, Damned Lies and Statistics, is published by the University of California Press. 333-9455 in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, call toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Joel Best, good afternoon. Welcome.
Well, thank you.
Thank you for joining us this afternoon. Damned Lies and Statistics, it's not Mark Twain.
It probably isn't. He's often given credit for the expression, but in his autobiography he says there are lies, damned lies, and statistics, but he claims that it was said by Benjamin Disraeli. Now, I cannot find where Disraeli said that, but Twain was not reluctant to take credit for a funny line, so I think that probably he thought Disraeli had said it.
Hmm. I suppose this demonstrates, though, how once we take hold of what we think is fact, it can be difficult to let go of that misinformation because I thought it was Mark Twain.
Well, it's interesting. When you see that attributed, sometimes it's Disraeli, sometimes it's Twain. The quotation dictionaries will sometimes say it's Disraeli. They'll say it's attributed to Disraeli, whereas they'll give other Disraeli quotes and explain where it comes from. So I don't know.
Hmm. Why do we tend to treat statistics as facts?
Oh, I think that goes right back to third grade. In third grade, we have a unit on facts and opinions. And I think that one of the things we learn is that if there's a number in a sentence, it's a fact. There are 50 states. That's a fact. And there's a tendency to assume that if someone gives you a number, the number must represent something. Somebody must have counted something, and they know how many there are. And I think that we just sort of automatically assign factual status to sentences with numbers in them.
Hmm. When did people begin using numbers to define social problems?
Well, it's the word statistics goes back to about 1830. And the people that were originally using statistics were interested in measuring social phenomena, births, deaths, marriages, things like that. They believed that a larger population was a sign of social vitality. And these folks were called statists, and then the numbers that they used became statistics. By the 1830s, the term was in fairly common use, and people were already suspicious. You begin to get references to forms of the quotation that you can prove anything with statistics. There's an 1840 book that says you can prove anything with figures, for example.
Mm-hmm. You note early in the going that many of us suffer from at least a mild case of innumeracy.
Oh, yes.
And that, in part, leads us to accept the figures we hear from sources quoted in the media.
Yeah, innumeracy is the mathematical equivalent of illiteracy. And, you know, most of us have this to one degree or another. You know, we're not very confident about differences between numbers, about the size of numbers. There's a tendency to say, well, it's a big number, and all big numbers are about alike. You know, a million, a billion, what's the difference? And, of course, you know, we would never make that mistake if we were dealing with smaller numbers. You know, everybody can tell you the difference between $1 and $1,000. Well, you know, it's the same order of magnitude between 1 million and 1 billion. A billion is 1,000 millions. But we tend to let these big numbers just kind of blur, and I think that really contributes to our not being very critical about the figures that we hear.
At the outset of the book, you share with readers an example regarding the number of children killed by guns in this country. And that's an example that if we took just a little bit of time, we'd realize something was very wrong with that statistic. You want to share that with us?
Yeah, this is a funny story. I received a dissertation abstract from a student, or a prospectus from a student. This was intended to be a dissertation. And it started with a quotation, which was intended to grab your attention. And the quotation said, every year since 1950, the number of children gunned down in America has doubled. And I looked at that and I thought, well, that's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard. And I went over to the library because I was pretty sure the student had managed to miscopy the quotation, and I looked up the journal where this statement appeared, and lo and behold, that was in fact what it said. Every year since 1950, the number of children gunned down in America has doubled. Well, you know, let's imagine that in 1950 it was one. That would be two in 1951 and four in 1952 and so on. And, of course, everyone knows that numbers increase really fast when you start doubling. 1995 was the date that sentence appeared in print. And if we'd had one gun down children in 1950, in 1995 there would have been 35 trillion, which is a lot. You know, that's the kind of number that you only really hear in astronomy or economics. You don't hear it in social matters much. And I wrote the author of the article. I asked him, "Where did you get this notion that children, you know, the number of children gunned down was doubling each year?" And he wrote back and said that he'd gotten it from the Children's Defense Fund, which is, of course, a very prominent advocacy organization. And I looked at the Children's Defense Fund publication that he sent me to, and I discovered that they had phrased it rather differently. What they'd said was, since 1950, the number of children gunned down each year has doubled. In other words, it had doubled once. Mm-hmm. Okay? And I assume that, you know, he was trying to reword this perhaps to avoid plagiarism, and he managed to mangle it and create a wonderful mutant statistic with a completely different meaning. Now, what's interesting about the story, of course, is the graduate student read that, copied it down, you know, quoted it in the dissertation prospectus. The journal's still in the library. Presumably other innocents could come upon it, you know, and find the same bogus fact. And, you know, as you said earlier, you know, things that we think are facts tend to live on. They take on lives of their own. And that claim could reappear any number of times in, you know, decades down the road.
Yeah, but that's an example that if we took just a little time, it would be easy enough to figure out that that just can't be right. I'm wondering, are other problem statistics as easy to uncover?
Oh, I think so. I think so, although sometimes it requires just a bit of knowledge. Another example from the book is a fairly notorious case. In the early 1990s, you would run into claims that the number of deaths from anorexia was about 150,000 a year. Now, you know that's a lot. And of course, you know, if you ask someone, "Gee, how many people do you think die of anorexia each year?" they're going to tell you, "Well, I don't know. It's probably a lot." Well, 150,000 is a lot. You know, that must be about right. And that was a number that was repeated over and over and over again. It was repeated in best-selling books. It appeared in magazine articles, newspaper articles, and so on. And it's absolutely ridiculous. Anorexia is a disorder that mostly affects young women, and the total number of young women from, say, 15 to 25 who die each year is in the neighborhood of 9,000. And that includes all of the, you know, deaths from disease, auto accidents, homicides, suicides, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know, if 9,000 young women die each year, what are the chances that there are 150,000 people dying from anorexia? Not good.
Yeah.
Yet bright people, smart people, repeated that statistic without even thinking about it.
Hmm. Why? What went wrong with that statistic? I mean, how did that statistic come about? Was it
that, the way that this got in circulation? They got mutated and put in circulation was that a newsletter for the American Anorexia Bulimia Association had an article where a physician estimated that 150,000 cases of anorexia might be happening at any one time, and you know this is a serious problem. Some people die from this, and this article was read and cited in a book published by a very prominent university press. Except that the author converted that 150,000 people have anorexia to 150,000 people die from anorexia, mm-hmm. and once it was in an authoritative scholarly book, then a variety of folks started to pick it up, and it circulated into, you know, newspapers and magazines and so on.
Yeah. As the chair of sociology and criminal justice at the University of Delaware, what kinds of problems have you encountered recently with statistics on crime?
Well, my favorite statistic currently is not exactly crime, but we have all of these estimates for bullying. Bullying is becoming a problem. This is something that this is a concern that has been imported. I think Americans aren't necessarily aware of this, but it's a concern about bullying in both Europe and Japan has been ongoing for any number of years, and there's been an effort to try and raise concern. There was a prominent well-covered article in a medical journal that appeared 2 or 3 months ago where someone did a survey and found that in the United States, I think something like a quarter of young people were bullied. Well, you know, obviously the problem with a statistic like that is it's hard to know what to make of it. You know, people are treating bullying as very important right now because they have pointed to a couple of the school shooting cases and said the shooters had been bullied, and therefore we ought to be worrying about bullying. Well, okay. After the newspaper article about this medical report appeared, I went into my class, large class, and I asked the students, how many of you have been bullied? Well, we'd all been bullied. All of us can probably remember some point in our life when somebody picked on us. And, you know, that turns the experience of bullying into something that isn't very useful as an explanation. If everybody has been bullied, then bullying, the experience of having been bullied, is not going to explain school shooting or anything else. And I think that there's a tendency to, you know, to create research, and if you go to the medical journal and look at the article, you discover that the definition of bullying is very generous. It includes all manner of things. It includes, I believe, making faces at people, among other things. And, you know, if you have a sufficiently broad definition, then of course you can produce a number of any size that you want. You know, why stop at a quarter of students being bullied? Why shouldn't it be, 100% at that point?
Hmm. Well, in that case, we have a definition that's probably too broad. On the other hand, you know, when a problem or a potential problem comes to light,
mm-hmm.
it seems likely that people are going to guess as to the scope of the problem.
Oh, absolutely. That's right.
And if we know that up front, is guesstimation fair? Is it a good thing? Is it a good thing that we look at bullying and say, hey, what about this?
Well, I think that what happens is that, when you're trying to draw attention to a problem that has been neglected, nobody's been paying attention to this, and you're trying to get people aroused, concerned about the issue. One of the things that's going to happen is that you're going to be approached by the media, and the media are going going to ask you, well, how big is this problem? Let's have some numbers. Editors will often send reporters back to get numbers. And, you know, at that point, nobody really knows. One of the symptoms of having neglected something is that nobody's been counting it. And so there isn't any good statistical information on the size of this new problem. And so what tends to happen is people guess. They take a stab in the dark, you know, a ballpark estimate, their best guess, whatever it is, and they say, you know, well, we think it's about this big. Now, there are two problems with that. One is that these folks are probably not going to underestimate the size of the problem. You know, they're convinced it's a big problem. They're convinced it's hidden. They are likely to err on the side of generosity. But that's, as you say, that ought to be okay. You know, after all, we ought to have some kind of estimate. It's the only number out there. But what happens is that once the number appears, it takes on a life of its own. It becomes repeated. It becomes referred to. It becomes improved upon. It becomes the foundation for other sorts of claims. And people very quickly forget that this was originally just somebody's best guess. I don't think there's anything wrong with a guess that's labeled a guess, but I think that what happens is that time and again, guesses turn into facts. An example of this would be the treatment of stalking in the early 1990s. People were concerned about stalking. Some reporter asked, how much stalking is there? And there's an article in News Magazine where a psychiatrist estimated that there might be 200,000 people with a stalker's characteristics, whatever that is, okay? And once that 200,000 number had appeared, it spread everywhere. You could pick up, I've looked at many, many law review articles about stalking, and they almost all have that 200,000 figure. And the idea that this is, you know, a guess from some psychiatrist just gets completely lost, and it becomes a fact. It is a statement about the magnitude of the problem. That, I think, is troubling.
Hmm. Are people reluctant to challenge statistics? I mean, it seems to me that if I was a reporter out working on a story that there were some significant statistics being thrown about, that I might want to check them out. And if I came up with a different answer, that might make a really good story.
Well, it could. I mean, people get Pulitzer Prizes for doing that. You know, in the middle 1980s, the Denver Post won a Pulitzer Prize for finally taking apart the wildly inflated estimates of the missing children movement. But those estimates have been out there for about 4 years before anybody did that legwork. I think that what happens typically is that the reporter's job is not so much to find the truth as to find evidence which can be attributed to a source, okay? And you'll find, if you read newspaper articles or listen to the news, they never say there are 200,000 stalkers. What they'll say is experts say there are 200,000 stalkers or whatever. Now, regardless of how many stalkers, if you found some expert to say that, that's a true statement, okay? And I think that by and large, reporters don't have the time, they don't have the resources, they oftentimes don't have the knowledge, you know, to get better information. And this is particularly true if we're talking about new social problems. When people are just originally thinking about a problem, when it's, as I say, been neglected, there aren't any better numbers. You know, it's hard to figure out how the reporter is going to come up with better information. So I think there's a natural tendency to just, you know, be happy that you got information from a source and publish it.
What are your thoughts about the early predictions about the spread of AIDS and how that story was reported?
Well, it looks pretty irresponsible today. I mean, you had wildly inflated claims about the scope of the problem. You know, there. I've now forgotten the details, but Oprah on one of her programs estimated that some very large proportion of Americans would be dead you know, I think by 1990 or 1995, something like that. You know, I think that on the one hand, of course, the justification for doing this is, hey, this is a problem. It, you know, people who were concerned about AIDS were trying to get other people to take the problem seriously, to put some money into it, to do something about it. And, of course, in the very first years of the epidemic, the problem was largely neglected by the authorities. It wasn't getting a lot of attention. So drumming up fear and implying that AIDS was much more likely to spread to a much larger segment of the population than in fact was the case was a tactic that I think was used fairly deliberately. You know, is it okay to lie? Can we justify that? Well, I don't know. It goes back to the standard kind of question about does the end justify the means? And I think that a lot of times people have made that bargain when they float numbers that they know are probably incorrect. Now, I would say, too, that I think people are not necessarily intentionally lying when they produce bad numbers. I think that oftentimes people, you know, are concerned, they're enthusiastic about the importance of the cause that they're promoting, and they are, they sometimes let their imaginations and their enthusiasms get the better of them, so that the numbers aren't very plausible, but they're delivered, I think, sincerely.
Hmm. Joel Best is our guest this afternoon. He's professor and chair of sociology and criminal justice at the University of Delaware. He's the author of several books. His latest is Damned Lies and Statistics, Untangling Numbers from the Media, Politicians, and Activists. The book is published by the University of California Press. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, if you'd like to talk with us, give us a telephone call in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll free, 1-800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Listeners waiting to talk with us in Champaign County on line 4. Good afternoon.
Hi. This isn't the point I called about, but pertinent to what you were just talking about, the AIDS spread as a worst-case scenario if no countermeasures were... I mean, that has happened in Africa, so there is something to the idea that it could spread widely. So I think there's more to be talked about there, but I'm not really prepared at this point. I wanted to ask you, because you haven't really, it seems to me, really looked at how statistics, rate of change, and what are some of the other, the sigma, you know, standard deviation, and... you know, just the way those kind of actual statistical devices, looking at the average and not knowing whether it's mean, median, or et cetera, those actual, you know, that are part of the actual statistics.
Mm-hmm.
But I wish you'd say something about that. But also, I'm struck by this report that the tobacco industry just did for the Czechs. I don't know if you heard that news story yesterday, but they're trying to persuade them not to put excise or taxes on tobacco, raise it, and they gave them figures that show that they would spend less on health care if they didn't try to curb tobacco use, because people will die earlier. Now, that's, this I mean, this is honest to God, they did this, and this it is a macabre sort of hilarity, I think. What were they thinking? I mean, even in the U.S. Constitution, there's a little thing that says promote the general welfare. What is the health service, and what are they for? If I mean, to help people die earlier so they don't have to pay for their health care? You know, I hope it blows up in their face. And it's not really per se a statistical thing, just like the other things you were talking about. It is what are statistics for kind of thing, as opposed to a misleading by statistics. And I'll have to hang up and listen off the air.
Okay.
Well, that's a lot of things. Let me say, first of all, that I don't talk about what most social scientists would call statistics in the book. That is, if you take a statistics course, you almost, certainly within the first week, you start talking about complex so forth. What I was trying to do in writing this book was deal with the kinds of numbers that we hear see in the news, and basically, percentages, rates, raw counts, things like that. I think that there are more technical books about the interpretation of more complicated statistics, but I don't think that's the problem that I'm particularly interested in. What I'm interested in is the way that numbers drive discussions of social problems, and typically those are very simple numbers. There are a couple cases in the book that are a little bit more complicated, but by and large, what we're really interested in are those simple numbers, 200,000 stalkers or whatever.
Yeah. Let me here just point out to the listener who called and asked those questions that there are three questions that the author, Joel Best, asks early in the book, and then he goes on to really then discuss these in depth. And I think that those are really worth mentioning at this point. Number one, who created this statistic? In the case that our listener mentioned, well, the Tobacco Institute should send up, some kind of a flag there. Number two, why was this statistic created? And number three, how was this statistic created? And those, I think, are really interesting and important questions to ask when us lay folks are reading the paper or, trying to sort through, what's what.
I think that's right. The Tobacco Institute, of course, has damaged its own credibility over the years through an extraordinary array of numeric claims that, I had not heard the one about tobacco as a cost-saving measure, but I think that, we sort of instantly start being suspicious when we hear things coming from them, which is interesting because you don't find that, they're almost the exception that proves the rule. By and large, when people trot out a number, the alarm bells don't go off, but they do with the Tobacco Institute.
Let's talk with another listener, this one on line one in Rantoul. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Hi. I have a candidate for you for at least as my favorite combination urban myth distortion of facts BS special. There's an urban myth about you'll frequently hear people say that if there is a firearm in the home that you're more likely to be injured by your own gun than if there isn't. And I've often wondered about that because I own firearms and I know a number of people who do, and somehow or other we've been managing to go through life without shooting each other or wounding one another, and so I decided to look into it. I went to the National Center for Disease Control, went to their website and looked up their most recent statistics, and I found out something sort of makes that idea true, but in a really profoundly pathetic way, in that for the last year they had statistics for, which I think was 1998, there were something like 46,000 deaths in the country involving firearms of all, every make and description you want to think of. A very significant percentage, and I'm if I remember right, it was 56%. It was something like 23,000 out of those 45,000 or 46,000 deaths were suicides. And assuming that the person who is committing suicide owns the firearm and he had it in his or her house at some time, that makes that statistic or that statement true. And it strikes me as in a really profoundly devious way, and one that does no one any service, with regard to the subject and so forth. And I'll hang up and listen to your comments. Thank you.
Sure. Yeah, guns are a incredibly contentious issue, and I think that it's fair to say that bad information about guns and bad numbers about guns are spread by both sides. If you look at public opinion polls, for example, you'll sometimes hear news reports saying that 3/4 of Americans favor more gun control, or 3/4 of Americans are opposed to gun control. gun control. Well, you know, typically the statements showing that they're opposed come from polls that have been organized by the National Rifle Association, and they will ask questions such as, you know, do you think that we ought to continue to protect the sacred Second Amendment right? You know, and, well, you ask the question that way, and you're very likely to get a response that would indicate that people are opposed to gun control. Similarly, the folks that do favor gun control tend to do very much the same thing. That is, they tend to word questions, do you favor keeping guns out of the hands of criminals? Well, you know, very few folks are unwilling to favor that. I don't know. I have not looked at the specific statistics you have about firearm deaths, but one thing that I would suggest is that you want to be very careful when you listen to statistics about firearm deaths, because they combine three categories, as you suggest: homicides, suicides, and accidents. And I think that, you know, I know that in the social science literature, in the sociological literature, there is a very crabby debate about whether guns make you safer or less safe. And I guess what I would say about that is that, you know, I think that ball's still up in the air. There are people, smart people, who really disagree about that, and their disagreement comes from framing the question in somewhat different ways and measuring the effects in somewhat different ways. And that's often the case. When you get disagreements, very often people, disagreements about statistics, very often people have rival ways of defining the problem or measuring it.
Let's talk with another listener. On line two in Danville. Hi.
Hi. I got several things. One, you kind of brung it out in that last call and earlier about statistics, is how can you trust not necessarily the bias of the person giving it, but the information is coming in, because if they, say, poll people more than a statistic, that people say, like, say, poll the universities in the United States and ask them, is the earth flat or round? And if a big percentage of the students just say flat, should the data say, well, they believe it's flat, therefore what is wrong with the education of the system? These kids here don't even know the earth is round. And another thing is, like, the census, they take around every 10 years. Granted, it's supposed to be just a head count, but they ask other questions, but people are reluctant to tell them any information for whatever reasons. And another thing is, people don't know how big the whole number is. If I mention a huge number, like so many billion, well, that's of the whole world population. Well, that's only 0.1%. And if we're, like, thinking back to about the weather, being like global warming, et cetera, we don't know what the weather really was 500 years ago, because it only had kept track for roughly 100 years.
Well, that's a lot of material there, Joel Best.
Yeah.
You want to start there?
Just wishing I'd taken notes. We kind of bounced from topic to topic.
But one thing, let me kind of fine-tune one of the questions here.
Okay.
On the polling question, you know, we see, like the caller, you know, alluded to, maybe I think what he was getting at was sort of some of these polls that are done that are kind of ridiculous, like, is the world flat? I mean, is the earth flat or round, and that kind of thing. And media, news media, are doing this every day. They're, you know, what do you think? You know, they'll put up a report, and what do you think? Thoughts on the value of those polls?
Well, yeah, the there are two issues with polls. There are three issues. One is how is the question worded, that I just talked about. A second one, which most people catch on right away, and I think the caller was referring to this, is oftentimes samples seem very small. You may have polls that are, you know, just a few hundred people, 400 or 500 people. The better national polling services only talk to between 1,000 and 1,500 people for a national survey. So those numbers seem small. That really is not the issue, however. The key issue with any survey is the sample random? Is it representative of the population that you're trying to generalize about? And, you know, when you log on to the Internet and there's a poll there and you can click, you know, President Bush is doing a good, bad job, whatever, you know, the results of that are absolutely meaningless, because there is no random sample, and it really doesn't matter how many millions of people might respond to that. There's no way that the sample of people who are responding is representative of the population as a whole. By and large, it's expensive to get good representative samples, and, you know, very often the samples that we read about aren't very good. They aren't very representative, and there's good reason to be suspicious of that.
Okay. Let me ask about the caller mentioned the census, and before we run out of time, I want to ask you about this, too.
Mm-hmm.
We've had all kinds of political discussion about the census and how it's done. Are there better methods for making a better count? An adjusted count is a political issue. And what are your thoughts about using sampling and polling techniques to adjust the count?
Well, I think most social scientists would support adjusting the count. You know, when you hear about a Gallup poll or some other national poll, there's an excellent chance, if it's done by a reputable polling agency, that they have weighted the sample, because they know that when they ask questions, they tend to get more responses from some segments of the population than others. And if they want to get an accurate reading of public opinion, they have to adjust those figures. Now, the problem with the census, of course, is that participating in the census is a kind of civic obligation, and people envision this as sort of a headcount. It's like having your third-grade class line up and take attendance each day. The problem is that, you know, it's an enormously complicated operation. They counted something approaching 300 million people last year, and there's a lot of slippage. There are overcounts. For example, very commonly, college students who are living in the dorm away from home get counted twice. Mom and dad count them at home, and then they get counted in the dorm. And there are particularly undercounts, people who either aren't contacted by the census or more often, you know, suspect that they don't want to respond and choose not to respond. And, you know, both the undercounts and the overcounts are in the millions of people. So that the census is not a simple headcount. It's off, and we know it's off. Now, it isn't off by very much. It's off by, you know, a percent or two, and that's really pretty good. I mean, we put a lot of effort into getting an accurate census count, and we do reasonably well. But even so, you know, it makes a difference. It's consequential because it's no longer an issue of just how many people do we have. We tie various political goodies, you know, apportioning legislative districts, passing out federal dollars, and so on, are determined on the basis of census counts. And so people naturally want to get the largest possible count. In general, you know, it's probably fair to say that if you adjust the census, you'll have more people in Democratic districts. And therefore, Republicans have generally been opposed to adjusting the census, and Democrats have generally favored it. I think that if you just left it up to social scientists, they would probably favor adjusting the census, but it's really a political, in addition to a scientific issue.
Let's talk with another listener, this one in Champaign on line 3. Hi.
Oh, good morning. Good morning. Enjoying this. My favorite statistic is, I'll live forever as long as I live to be 103. But what I wanted to talk about is the way Philadelphia changed their statistics. I lived there over 25 years.
Mm-hmm.
And for years and years, the crime would get worse and worse and worse.
Mm-hmm.
So finally, they decided we've got to do something about this because the people are getting up in arms.
Mm-hmm.
So they recategorized some of these crimes to a lesser degree.
Mm-hmm.
And then they could throw them out.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, oh boy, this year the crime is way down and everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. And that's a good case of something we were talking about earlier, where reporters broke that story. They discovered that there'd been a good deal of hanky-panky in the Philadelphia police system's reporting of crime rates. And the crime rate has gone up dramatically in the last couple of years, not necessarily because crime has increased, but because the police are being watched more carefully and they are recording the crimes more accurately. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good point.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. We're running down on time. Let's see if we can get another caller or two in. Next, we go to Eureka on line 4, a listener there. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. The other day I went to the Oprah Winfrey website, and there was something about sexual abuse, and it was claimed that 1 out of 4 or 5 children in America experience that. One hears many of those same kinds of statistics about, I mean, it's an awful thing. I don't think there's any debate about that. Would you have any comment about the use of some of those statistics?
Yeah, they're probably inflated. This is another touchy issue. It partly depends upon how you measure things and so on. But I think that most reputable authorities would argue that unless you define sexual abuse very, very broadly, it would not be 1 in 4, 1 in 5.
Yeah, there's an interesting anecdote in the book about defining sexual violence. And is it flashing? Is it a grope? Is it rape? You know, that kind of thing. It's how is sexual violence defined is going to determine how many instances of it.
Yeah, that's true for absolutely everything.
Yeah.
We take numbers and we tend to focus on the number, and what we should be doing is thinking a little bit more critically about what was the definition, because you can debate the definitions. You can say they're too broad or too narrow.
Let's talk with another listener in Urbana on line one. Hello.
Yeah, you brush off putting the spotlight on people in law enforcement and the way they distort figures.
I didn't mean to do that.
Well, I would. The host started out with a question: what's it like? I mean, tell us about distortion of statistics within. Law enforcement, for example, and you didn't quite answer that. And this last lady talking about Philadelphia, it isn't only Philadelphia. It's happened in a lot of places. And I just think...
No, they got caught. That's
yeah.
The difference. No, I think, this is quite right. You know, one of the first lecture that you have in any criminology course is usually disabusing the students of having complete faith in the crime rate. Crime statistics are obviously imperfect, and they're imperfect because a lot of crimes don't get reported. And we also do find lots of studies showing that when the crimes are reported, there sometimes various kinds of bureaucratic slippage, some of it not at all innocent, as agencies try and manipulate the figures. I used to teach in a small rural area, and the sheriff's department the police department created a bicycle theft form. And what this did was it allowed them to reduce the number of larcenies that they had to report to the FBI. And it was a very deliberate attempt to try and alter the crime rate. I think this is probably, it's not just law enforcement, of course. Lots of bureaucrats are engaged in record keeping, and sometimes, their budgets and other things depend upon coming in with big with the correct numbers at the end of the year. And, there are different ways of playing numbers games to make that happen.
If you were looking at crime figures, just as they were reported in the newspaper, let's say, how would you go about evaluating them, Jeff?
Well, the best crime figures are not the crime rate from the FBI. The best crime figures are the reports from the National Crime Victim Surveys, which the government also releases, although the FBI releases theirs quarterly, and I think the NCVS only comes out annually. And the reason that's more accurate is the government samples a very large and representative sample population, it's about 120,000 people, and asks them, have you been a victim of a crime in the last year? Now, they then ask, if people say yes, they ask, have you reported the crime? And what you discover is that close to half of all crimes that people are willing to tell the interviewers about never got reported to the police. Okay? Mm-hmm. So, the crime rate always understates the total amount of crime because some crimes don't get reported.
Yeah. Interesting. We're out of time.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon. Joel Best has been our guest this afternoon here on The Afternoon Magazine. He's a sociologist. He is author of Damned Lies and Statistics, Untangling Numbers from the Media, Politicians, and Activists. The book is published by the University of California Press. Joel Best is professor and chair of sociology and criminal justice at the University of Delaware.